Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 6. Now, we're talking about a typical raid, which we're considering to have been on one of the three on Hamburg.
Yes.
Without, as just for sake of ease, to give something to pin it on to.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned that this film, because you were... Now, that's when you've got out again. Take us through to where that film starts and explain what you mean by the film that was taken.
Shall I, first of all, go back a bit and say how it came about to lead into it?
Have you got to the point where the film starts yet in describing what happened? Cause
no, not yet.
No, right, okay. No.
Because there's something more to that, because it was Churchill wanted the film being made.
Now, what film?
The Butterbit, the Ministry of Information film, The Butterbit, to let the British public know what Bomber Command were doing. And
now, hang on, that was taken on your last mission?
No. Yeah, on the last one, but Remscheid.
Okay,
right.
Yeah, we'll come back to that another time.
We're not onto that yet.
We'll skip that entire for a minute.
No, yeah.
So what happened? You picked up your flying kit from the airlock. It's my fault that.
No, that's okay. Yeah.
So we picked up your flying kit.
Yeah.
What happens next?
We've gone, as I said, we've gone down to, through the hangar, picked up our kit, then continued through to outside the hangar, where we waited as a crew for the crew bus to take us out to the aircraft. We'd given, obviously, time for takeoff, so we were milling about there maybe for 20 minutes or so, or a bit more.
And what was this crew bus? Was it just one per crew? Or
no, it was. Well, it took several, maybe two or three crews. It was a bus, and with RF driver, of course. And so he would bowl up to get us out to the aircraft, do our pre-flight preparations. And so that was what happened. Now we would be waiting there. First, the navigator would have gone for his quick briefing and got his map, a chart bag and everything with him. And then once we were all crew, then the crew bus came round, the crews got in, more than one bus, obviously. If we could be having 18 crews on that night, if it was a maximum effort. So, and then as after our night flying tests, the aircraft were then bombed up and fueled up, and then they were marshalled along a perimeter track.
Now, what does marshalled mean?
Well, they were lined up, spaced out, facing inwards on the perimeter track, ready for takeoff. So they were marshalled, bombed up, fueled up, marshalled, ready for us to get into and take them off.
Now, what about, you mentioned the pre-flight checks. What were the pre-flight checks? When you got to the aircraft, what would you do, you know?
Well, the skipper would go through everything. I would check, the gunners would check our guns, the wireless operator would check his position, the flight engineer would check all his dials and bits and pieces. So we were doing all this stuff, and then the skipper would call through. We'd obviously put our kit on before we got into the aircraft. We'd carry that with us from the hangar, where we picked it up from our locker, to the aircraft. We would then dress ourselves up in all this stuff, get into the aircraft, do our little checks. Skipper would call through to each position, make sure we were okay, and we would answer. And then we would wait for the green. Whilst we were doing it, before we got on board, the CO, if he wasn't flying with us that night, he would come round, make sure everything was okay. The gunnery leader and the other leaders would also come round, have a chat, and also the padre. And the MO would also come round and ask the gunners if they wanted any wakey-wakey pills.
Now, what were the wakey-wakey pills?
Well, there was a heavy caffeine or benzodrine to keep you awake.
And did people...
I didn't want anything to keep me awake, I can tell you.
So you didn't take them?
No. I don't think many chaps did. Because I heard of a case once where this had happened, and and the op was scrubbed, and the guy in particular couldn't get any sleep that night because he'd taken these blinking pills. So no, I never bother with stuff like that. Right, we're now ready to go. We're waiting for the green. We get the green.
Now, what is the green?
The green is the Aldis lamp from the control caravan at the end of the runway. And then we, as we've been marshalled, so we come round in sequence, as it were. Taxi up, turn round, and then we're ready to go. We're off. And that's it, really. And we, the navigation lights are on up to 5,000 feet, then they're off. Oxygen comes on at 10,000 feet. And so, therefore, we now have our course to turn onto.
So the takeoff was just, there's nothing to say about that, he just took off.
Just took off, yeah, just took off.
Now, what was the oxygen, what were the arrangements? That's oxygen masks, is it?
Yeah, oxygen mask, and of course within the mask there was the microphone, and then of course you had the earphones in your flying helmet.
Now that was for the intercom.
Yeah.
Was there any way of using the intercom? I mean, could you just, was it on all the time?
Oh no, only the gunners up, because otherwise it can be a bit disconcerting, people breathing and getting noises through to the other. And the gunners, obviously, for obvious reasons, were allowed to keep their microphones on all the time. For quick response, you see. And the other thing I was trying to think of last week was the economizer. The oxygen went through an economizer so that you only got oxygen as you breathed. It wasn't a constant flow of oxygen, only when you breathed, hence the economizer.
Now, the course, the flow, that was obviously the job of the navigator, nothing to do.
Yes, yeah, he set course, he tell the skipper when to turn on the course for the first leg, and
now you flew independently, didn't you, or did you?
Yes, we flew in a stream. You couldn't fly in formation at night, so we flew in a stream. So you've got maybe 500 or more in the case of, say, Hamburg, 700 aircraft, all converging eventually onto a target. So there's a great stream of aircraft spread out across the sky, lengthwise and widthwise, until they start converging like a funnel onto the target. And that's how it was. And obviously everybody turned on at the turning points, at the appropriate turning points, and changing course and so on and so forth.
But each done by the navigator independently.
Exactly. Yes.
Did they have this H2SO?
H2S was on some aircraft. H2S, first of all, and at the time I was operating, it was only on PFF aircraft.
Pathfinders.
Yes, the Pathfinders had H2S. We had G. Everybody had G.
Now, what's G?
That's a navigation aid, a short-distance navigation aid.
Just a single letter G.
G-double-E, G. That was the code name, G-double-E, yes.
And how did that work?
There were two stations transmitting in Britain, and as they converged, that showed up on a screen, on a cathode ray tube, and the navigator could read that and check our position from that cathode ray tube onto his charts.
Now,
yeah, special charts.
What was the environment like in the aircraft? Did you know what I mean by environment? I mean, you're in a thing. I mean, was it noisy? Was it smelly? What was it?
It wasn't. Well, because aeroplanes, they smelt metallic, they smelt of dope, they smelt of leather, they smelt of all those mixture of things. But to me, it wasn't unpleasant. It was. I think it got to be sort of homely to me, quite frankly.
And the noise didn't bother you?
No. I mean, the engines were noisy, of course, but it didn't bother me, no. It didn't bother me at all, not in the least. No, the Stirling was all turrets were the same in any airplane, but I liked the Stirling. It was a good walk-through airplane, if you like. There were nothing going through the fuselage, like spars or something, to interrupt the as you walk through the airplane.
Now, what would you do? Would you, it's a long flight. What would you do?
Well, once we got over the English Channel or whatever, North Sea, gunners tested their guns. So we fired off a few rounds into the sea, make sure they were okay, clear the guns. And then it was a question of pressing on then and just continuing on course. If we saw anything worth reporting, we would. Otherwise, we kept our trap shut.
Now, what sort of thing would you report?
Well, if we saw something unusual, if we saw perhaps an airplane going down or something like that, or if as we cross the enemy coast, I or the rear gunner would report any searchlight activity, either to port or starboard or whatever, or any flak going up, which was worth telling. It could be logged in, you see. The navigator could log it. But apart from that it was all routine, really. There's nothing anybody could do. The navigator's at his table, he set the course, he's making sure that we're keeping to course.
Now, what was it like in your turret? I mean, would you just sit in there, basically?
Just sit in there.
Can you describe the turret in as much detail as you can, as it was in an actual in-action situation?
Well, it was it's difficult to say, really, because it was eventually it becomes routine. But the mid-up had a 360 traverse, so I would occasionally turn the turret completely round so that I had an overall view all around. So keeping check on the sky, because you never knew once you'd sort of got airborne, really, that you weren't going to get bounced by an enemy fighter, because they knew that we were taking off. They'd known right from early in the day, they'd picked us up with all the wireless traffic and all these aeroplanes doing air tests and so on. So they were waiting for us, really.
And which way would you normally point it?
I would normally point to the stern. But by doing that, because of my turret, the way it was built, like a huge bubble, whilst the turret may have been pointing to the stern, I could see on both beams as well. And then if I wanted to look up front, then I'll merely turn the turret and look up front. Simple as that, really.
And would you be constantly looking round?
Absolutely, constantly.
Even when you were over the channel?
Oh, without question, yeah, because you could say, oh, there won't be any enemy fighters here, because they totally well could be. I mean, very often on the way back, they'd follow our taps in and shoot them down.
That's what you were basically doing, scanning the skies all the time.
Yes.
And it was German fighters you were particularly looking for.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's why, that was our job.
Were you aware of German fighter tactics at the time? Had you been?
Well, we were aware that we knew that they were vectored onto us by radar. They were very at the time I was operating. They were very, very good, probably reaching their peak, their German defences, and they had all this sophisticated radar stuff, and we were in constant danger, really, to be honest.
But did you know how they attacked? You know, their actual tactics?
Yes, they...
Would it be one at first?
Their normal attack would come from the dark side of the sky, because believe it or not, there was a darker side to one side, and they would attack you from there, and they'd do what we call a curve of pursuit attack, which was coming in behind, probably slightly higher on your beam, then they would curve in like that to come behind you. That was the normal tactic, because that changed later on. So therefore, that's what we were looking for. Occasionally, as we got near the target, they would use decoys. They'd operate in pairs. One would be hanging off with the lights on, so that the gunners were tempted to look there, while the other one came in on the darker side. So we had to watch out.
But it was never more than one or two. There were
no. Two.
And they didn't attack from below. At that stage?
Not at that stage, no. So I'm not saying that some of them didn't, but that wasn't their normal overall tactic at the time.
So the general tactic was from their beam to the dark side and curving in to take up a position behind.
Pursuit, yes.
And that would put them...
You learnt about this, or this at gallery school.
You mentioned the curve of the pursuit. And that would mean that both of the gunners would have a shot at them if they saw them.
Yes. The rear gunner, absolutely. Mid-upper, as I might explain later. Maybe not, because the tailplane came into your line of fire. And, of course, there was the... around the mid-upper turret, there was like a bulging thing that prevented you from lowering your guns. Thus, if you did that, you could hit the airplane.
So I was just going to ask what stopped you from hitting your own wings.
I forget what they were called now. There were two rods with tiny wheels on them, and they were protruding, and they came down as soon as they touched that bulge. Your guns automatically went up, so you couldn't shoot at yourself, if you like. So that was just one thing about the mid upper. But the rear gunner, of course, he had a complete field of fire.
So you're on one thing. It's a minor point there.
Yes.
But did you ever eat anything in the plane? On the way back.
We had
On the way back.
Yes. Oh, we had
not on the way there then.
No. No.
And what about going to the toilet? Was there any toilet around?
Yeah, there was just the Elson at the back. I never the Elson.
What's
chemical
that?
Toilet. That was at the rear of the aircraft near the exit door. And but I never used it.
Did any of the others?
No, but one night, I forget which one it was, but my skipper, we were almost on our bombing run, and George, my skipper, wanted desperately to go to the toilet, and he said, I'll put it in George, which was the automatic pilot. His name was George. And so I looked down the Elson. Of course, everybody opened their microphone and said, no, you won't. So Sid Long, our bomb aimer, he emptied his coffee out of his, we used to fill our flask, we all had a flask. He emptied his coffee out so that George could pee in his flask. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. oh dear. So I never did anything like that, and I don't know any of the rest of the crew who did it. But it was there in case we needed it, you see. But on the way back, we used to have.
Hang on, we haven't got there yet.
All right.
Now, so on the way there, then.
Yes.
You're constantly looking around. Occasionally, you're spinning your turret.
Yes.
Which was done hydraulically. So
yes.
You did it with the grips.
Yes.
Turning from side to side.
Yes.
So what happens as you start to get nearer and nearer the target for you and for the plane?
Started to get a funny itchy feeling in your pants and a slight bitter taste in your mouth, because we were now coming into the true danger zone, because not only are the fighters lurking and loitering around the target area, but also we've got to fly through all that flak, and we've got to try and dodge all those searchlights. So it's a fraught time, not only for the gunners, but also for all the other chaps, obviously. But they can't see anything, apart the skipper can, of course, the bomb aimer, but the other members of the crew, they're doing their business, and they're in the fuselage, you know, the navigator and the wireless operator, so they don't know what's going on. They can only go by what we're saying, you see. So that's it. So therefore, everything then is real tension as far as the gunners are concerned now. And so we're now into the target area. We're on our bombing run. The bomb aimer is now down in his position, and he's given the instruction. Bomb doors open. So the bomb doors open. And then we are now approaching our markers. We've been told, say, to bomb on the greens. So they've gone down. PFF have dropped they're dropping greens and reds, and perhaps whites, and so we're making for our greens, and so it's the usual thing then.
And you are the third wave?
We're invariably third wave, yes.
And yeah. That's what you were on Hamburg?
Yes, yeah.
And so as you get nearer the target, you've got the bomb doors open and you're flying in. What about flak, searchlights, fighters?
Well, there's barrels flak going off for a start.
So and what's that like?
Well, it's just shells bursting in the sky. They're just firing off barrage stuff. No particular aeroplane. But you've got to fly through it, and it can be fairly dangerous because you're now straight and level on your bombing run. So they could get lucky and hit you.
So this was like a wall of exploding shells?
Yes, yes, at various altitudes, you see. Their heavy flak was 88 millimetre and 105 millimetre. And because they had masses of searchlights in these towns, especially the Ruhr, because the Ruhr, if one of your targets in the Ruhr may be right in the Ruhr, and you've got to fly all the other places to get to it. So we're now on a bombing run.
Could you hear the flak?
And it's close, you can hear it, yes. And if it's really close, you can even smell it.
What did it smell of?
Yeah, well, yeah, Kordite. It's like Kordite.
And how close would it be to you, seemingly?
Well, maybe 30 yards, maybe 50 yards. You could get peppered with the stuff, and it may not do that much damage because it's at the end. But if it's really close, of course, that's when the damage when it starts doing your damage.
And what about the searchlights?
The searchlights would be waving about. Targets of opportunity, but of course the real danger was from the master beams. Now these were radar controlled and they were a bluish colour, rather a dense light, a bluish colour, and you could easily pick them out. But they were radar controlled and they were picking on people. They were picking up people individually. Once they did that, and that's what happened to us eventually.
We'll obviously come on to that, yeah. So all of this was going on. So what happened next? What were the actual bombing, dropping the bombs?
Right. We would be on our markers, as I say. There'd be directions given, the usual left, left, right, right, steady from the bomb aimer.
And you'd hear that through
the... Oh, absolutely, because everything we were open. And then... obviously his microphone was open, he's talking to the skipper, so once his sights on those markers, his bomb's gone, so the whole lot went together.
And did that make it, I mean, did the aircraft go up with the
I never felt it, no, I never felt it, strangely enough, in the
so
Stirling.
You wouldn't have known, but for...
No, except, bombs. No, there was no sort of lurch, as far as I can recall, and so... We would have to wait 10 seconds or so. That was about the time for our photograph. The photo flash would have gone with the bombs. And when it reached a certain altitude, it flat, it went off. And that's when we got our picture of our aiming point. And then it was flat out for home then.
There's no more messing about.
There's no more messing about. No, as Winco used to say, at briefing, when you've dropped your bombs and got your picture, come out, put your nose down and come out like a dingbat. And that's what we did. And then we'd have a course from the target, course to turn on, and then a course for home.
But no let off for you. You're still absolutely on.
Even more so now because, we were now desperate. Having got there and safely and done the business, we now... We were really desperate to get home safely as well, so it was. We sort of, you couldn't be doubly more alert because we were so alert anyway. But nevertheless, the tension was still there, and there was no letting up. And oh, what a relief we've done it! And let's go to sleep. None of that at all. That would be fatal. We couldn't do that.
So you carried on.
We carried on home. And all the time, of course, the sad thing was we could see aircraft going down, either being attacked by fighters or coned and the flak getting them and becoming a raging infernos and going down, which was not a happy sight. So
I presume you could see this more than the others more than as well.
Absolutely, yes. And wherever it was happening, I could see it. Because
would you know which aircraft it was?
No, you can only assume that if it was very close to when you had bombed, you can assume that it was a Stirling, because it was a three-group Stirling, because we were third wave. But of course, there could be other airplanes that were either from other groups, Halifaxes or Lancs.
Could you hear other aircraft?
Oh no,
not. I mean, through the wireless. I mean, was a breaking of wireless sounds or
No. There was no chat between aircraft, and there wouldn't be any. There was only intercom stuff. That's all. Whilst they're actually operating.
So, was this a policy of wireless silence then?
Well, there was no point to any of it anyway. There was no point to talking to other aircraft.
But was there wireless silence back to England? I mean, you could have to, for instance, if your bombs didn't drop.
Well, the wireless operator.
When a mission was being aborted, you'd have to.
The wireless operator sent a signal every half an hour. That's all. Back to base.
And what was that for?
Just to let them know where we were. Sort of a routine thing, really. That was the job of the wireless operator. Send a signal back. So all the aircraft were doing that. That was routine for everybody.
So you're flying back.
So we're flying back. We're getting close to the English coast.
Now you were going to tell that story about was it eating on the way back or something that you used to do on the way back.
Oh yes. Well, we had a flask of coffee, of course, and our flying rations on 15 was a tin of orange juice, sun-kissed orange juice, the Liechtenstein stuff from America, a bag of boiled sweets, which I never took with me, and a packet of chewing gum. I used to use that, and also a couple of bars of chocolate, small bars of chocolate. That we didn't take sandwich or anything like that. That was all we was.
That sounds like all pretty high energy stuff.
Yeah, well, I suppose it was, yeah. But I used to put the chocolate in my flying boots for easy access. The chewing gum I'd be used at chewing. In fact, you can see me put it in my mouth in that film. And drink the coffee. Get rid of that on the way back.
On the way back?
I never touched anything. I didn't want to be distracted in any shape or form whilst we're going to the target.
So just
but that would be getting close. Yeah, exactly. But getting close to home, then I wouldn't exactly relax, but I would give myself time to have that, and the rest of the crew would be the
same. Did you drink your orange juice?
I used to drink the orange juice before we took off, because if an op was scrubbed before we took off, we had to hand back the rations. So they weren't getting the orange juice back, so I used to drink that.
So orange juice was seen as a luxury. I mean, there weren't many oranges
no,
about.
No. So I used to punch a hole in the tin with my loading tool and drink that. So there's no way they were going to get that back if the op was scrubbed. They could have the chocolate and the sweets back, but not that.